What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
This is an old live taping of the Katie Halper Show that we did with Matt Karp, historian and writer. What's really cool about this episode is that even though it's a little old, it's a vintage, it's from the time of the Kansas special election, but you're going to find that it's super applicable to tonight's Georgia election. And Matt really explains what's wrong with the Democrats, what's wrong with their approach, and he refers to the Democratic vision as woke Goldman Sachs. And since Matt is a historian, he makes a lot of connections between history and today's politics. And he says he's inspired by the overthrow of the ruling class that we find throughout history. He talks about Frederick Douglass and about the use of the refrain, Bernie would have won. Matt's also kind of an expert in stats and voting patterns, so you're definitely going to want to listen. He also goes through various coalitions, talks about solidarity versus philanthropy. It's really one of the best episodes, so really excited to be dropping it tonight, given the Ossoff failure in the Georgia election.
Please welcome to the stage Matthew Karp, Princeton professor, historian, author of This Vast Southern Empire, Slaveholders at the Helm of American Foreign Policy, also writes for places like Jacobin and The Nation, and his probably most recent accomplishment is that he was retweeted by the Reverend Jesse Jackson. So, I mean, an article he wrote was retweeted. An article he wrote. It would be funny if you had made a D-I-C-K joke and he retweeted that or something. Not that you make those, but, right.
It was already the best day of my life, so
yeah.
It's okay.
Okay. So can you talk to us, Matt, first of all, about you? I want to do a history of you, right? How about we do a history of the historian? What made you a historian? What made you study history? And what is the connection between your historical writing and your journalism, which has really been, at least over the last year, focused on electoral and voting patterns, numbers, and I don't even know the word to use because that's how bad I am with these stats. What do you call it? Statistics?
it's actually pronounced statistics.
Statistics. Okay, statistics. You see, I told you. Thank you. Keeping me woke.
No, there aren't many statistics in that book. The real connection is that I finished this in January of 2016, and it looked like there was a socialist who was leading in New Hampshire, and I thought, well, I have a little bit of time here, so that sounds interesting. I've been spent like 12 years of my life pondering the career of Jefferson Davis. I wanted to die. I needed something to lift my spirits a little bit. And I think the Bernie Sanders campaign came along at the right time. So that was when I sort of poured my, at least my writing interest into Bernie.
So any connection or any continuity between what you write about?
Okay,
as
I mean, to be serious for a minute. Yeah, I mean, I think...
You have 60 seconds.
Okay. I mean, I think to the extent that this book... Okay, this is sort of a long shot, but this book is about the slaveholders who were in command of the American government for the... really for the first 80 years of the American Republic. and it especially concentrates on the 20 years before the Civil War. I mean, and this was a true ruling class. You know, these slaveholders controlled the presidency, you know, the cabinet had disproportionate power over Congress, the Supreme Court, everything. We sort of know about that. The book makes various arguments about how they also controlled American foreign policy, and they manipulated and directed that policy in order to sort of sustain slave property and support fellow slaveholding regimes in the hemisphere, oppose anti-slavery uprisings, slave rebellions, etc. One thing that's, you know, the book doesn't really get to this, but the politically relevant part here, that spending so much time on this ruling class and just remembering that this ruling class was overthrown. And to me, that's a continual source of tremendous inspiration when I think about American history. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to be completely naive and triumphalist about the American Civil War and its aftermath and the retreat from Reconstruction. You know, we could do a whole nother show on that. But that the slaveholding class, the slave power, was defeated democratically and then militarily. And I don't know. I find that an inspiring reminder. Even in the dark times that we are in today.
Nice.
I mean, I was sort of like pushing at that in that Douglas piece too.
Yeah.
That was kind of the same sort of thing. So if Frederick Douglass didn't give up, you know, we have no license to.
Right. And so can you tell us about your Frederick Douglass piece? Was this because, I don't know if this came out before Trump praised him for the great work he's doing. Was this piece why he said that, or was your piece in response to that?
Trump obviously knew that I had like this draft that had been like, you know, bouncing around on email since October.
Right.
And then, no, I was actually really annoyed when he came on
and
he learned who Frederick Douglass was and tried to place a phone call to him. I don't know if he got Frederick Douglass on the record, but it seemed like he had a really illuminating conversation with Frederick Douglass. That was annoying because I was like, oh, I wanted them to post it like right away. I wanted to be super topical.
Right.
I've been working on that for a long time because, I mean, I actually honestly do think that Douglass, who the most, I think, important stage, influential stage of his career in the 1850s, the same moment that the slave power was at its height, the kind of power of reaction in America was arguably at one of its heights, and Douglass, sort of his role as a sort of crusading editor and, you know, leader of the resistance, no hashtag,
right.
Is his words in terms of thinking about how to build a coalition that could defeat our modern day ruling class are really relevant, and especially his refusal to sort of give in to paralysis and despair, which is all too common in certain sections of the sort of liberal media sphere after the election, for sure.
And for people who haven't read the piece, which they really should, it was in The Nation, and we know they should because Jesse Jackson retweeted it. Can you just share with people what the kind of takeaways are from what Frederick Douglass did?
Yeah, I mean, just building off what I said before. I mean, look, I mean, Douglass, if you read Douglass's newspaper column, say, you know, he gives this great speech after, in early 1857, James Buchanan's president from Pennsylvania, but his Democratic Party is almost entirely dominated by slaveholders. The slave power is the ruling force in his administration. That he's collaborated with, you know, Chief Justice Roger Taney of Maryland to sort of push through this Dred Scott ruling, which says, you know, famously, black Americans have no rights, which a white man is bound to respect, that there's no ability to prevent slavery from expanding to the territories. This extreme reactionary decision. To be honest, it does. I mean, we'll see. I mean, maybe now with Gorsuch in there, they're gonna try to match Dred Scott. But you know, the most reactionary decision in American history, and you know, devastating. And you know, they can completely control all the branches of government. And Douglass gives an amazing speech in response to this decision, which is obviously devastating to him personally and his anti-slavery movement. And it's what's notable in contrast to so much of the dialogue today is how little ground he's willing to yield and how much he insists on the capacity to sort of use right-wing overreach to build a democratic movement that can overcome that right-wing power. I mean, the reason I wrote the piece is there's a new edition of like a portable Frederick Douglass that Penguin put out. It's, you know, it's pretty cheap. And what's cool about it is it includes a lot of that journalism. We know Frederick Douglass, a lot of us, to the extent that Donald Trump knows him personally. He's doing so many great things. But to the extent that we meet Frederick Douglass like in our high school curriculums or in college or whatever, it's usually the narrative. It's usually his life, which is powerful and, you know, it's amazing. And, he's a great rhetorician and all that. But I think what's cool about this new collection is it really includes a lot of his journalism, because that's what Douglas was. He was a political animal. He was not just a kind of great soul who escaped slavery and talked about how horrible it was. He was somebody who organized. He orated and he organized. He worked with other collaboratively with all sorts of different people in the anti-slavery movement, white and black. And he was instrumental in some ways. Even though he was critical of the Republican Party in the 1850s as it came together to destroy slavery, he ultimately supported it, I think offered a sort of, in some ways, offered a kind of vanguard of that movement. His journalism is really repays reading as much as anything else he wrote.
So I wanted to skip forward a little bit.
Yeah.
We're going to thread the needle. So, Matt, I wanted to talk to you about some tweets, actually, that you wrote.
Yes.
Because Twitter is the window, I say, into the where the soul would be of the media. In your case, you actually do have a soul, so it's especially exciting. But you were tweeting about the special election. So you tweeted a bunch about this special election that just happened in Kansas, and I get the sense that you felt all sorts of feels about it. Do you want to read some of your tweets about it, or do you want me to?
Is this like the Jimmy Fallon show or something?
Yeah, mean tweets. Like, mean tweets about Kansas.
Yeah.
You wrote, imagine...
Maybe my harshest owns of Tom Perez. This is
totally,
really...
Yeah. We should have an own-off about Perez. So imagine what Republicans would have done if the DCCC had given Thompson a few bucks and nationalized the race.
Wait, do you want to like... put this in context?
Oh, sure. Okay. You know what? Why don't you put it in context? You're the historian.
Well, look, there was you guys know about this special election in Kansas the other night, right? People seem to know about that.
That's such bad pedagogy. You can't do that.
What?
Do you do that to your students?
No, I assume an enormous level of sophistication because that...
No, you can't say that because then no one's going to say... Sorry.
No. Oh, that's true. Good point. Good point. I have no idea.
What's Kansas?
Is that a territory or a state?
Unclear.
Yeah. No. So there was a special election in Kansas last night. A Democrat guy who was actually a Bernie guy initially said he was inspired to run because of Bernie. And he, you know, his deep red district. It's literally the home of Koch Industries. It's one of the darkest, reddest districts in America around Wichita, the suburbs, rural area in South Kansas. It went like for Trump by 30. The Democrat in this race lost by 6. So it's a huge swing. The controversy to some extent was, okay, the national party, the congressional committee, didn't really support this Democrat at all, financially or otherwise. And there were all sorts of like little, you know, probably not very illuminating Twitter arguments about, you know, what should or could have been done. For me, what's relevant about this is not that I know so much about like Wichita politics or that I, you know, have a concrete sense of the 4th District of Kansas, but that the way that people were sort of justifying the Democratic Party was really shrewd to avoid this race, because if anybody knew that this candidate was a Democrat, then they would never vote for him, which is just like, what? I mean, first of all, he's a Democrat. That was the point of the Cruz tweet. Every Republican, when they're running against a Democrat, will say, this is a Democrat.
Right.
So it's just like, it's just on the surface, it's idiotic. Second, this idea that the Democratic brand or the idea of the Democratic Party is so toxic, is so unable to sort of relate or connect to anybody's life in, you know, outside of a certain bubble, is exactly what's wrong with what went wrong among many things for the Democratic Party this last time around. So I just found that to be, I mean, it's like...
And who was making that argument?
The same pundits who are like, Hillary's will, you know, win Michigan by 20 points.
But I'm actually surprised that they would be so honest about how terrible the Democratic brand is.
Look, okay, stepping off the polemic for a little bit, it's like, yeah, there are some races where, you know, you want to emphasize local issues versus national issues. Like, it's politics. It's all about timing and geography and whatever. But, the idea that, you know, supporting, giving grassroots or financial support, you know, without, like, making a big hubbub about it to a candidate would inherently tar that candidate with your own toxicity is bizarre. The one guy was like, oh, the Democrats need to fly under the radar. That's how they can pull this off. It's like the Democratic Party is like literally its strategy for the midterms is like exiling itself in a quiet car on the Northeast Corridor train to Rahway or something.
Right.
That's like all they want to do. And the larger point though is about their strategic focus. This Kansas race, this Montana race, which is the same thing, has not gotten a lot of support. Again, it's a Bernie guy who's like for healthcare, single payer, da 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 da. And he's has had very little, if any, media or national support. But they're pouring everything into the Georgia suburbs because they think it's a winnable race. So there's like a, we could argue about tactics or whatever. But to me, it says something about the kind of coalition they want to build. They want a coalition, just like they said during the election, that's grounded in the rich suburbs, because that's the kind of party they want. They want, as Arish was saying, they want a party of you know, of woke Goldman Sachs. They want that's the kind of, if they have that, if they have those voters in their coalition, they have the policies that those voters want. And I think, you know, that's troubling.
And then they can pretend that they have to have those policies, right? Because they have to represent their constituents, as opposed to what I think the truth is, which is a combination of both, but that they want those policies.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, they say, oh, you know, the, you know, voters in suburban Georgia aren't going to go for Medicare for all. You know, they're part of our coalition. We can't lose.
Right.
I mean, it goes back to the 2016 election. This is my like little two theories of two coalitions for the Democrats. That if you're just trying to look neutrally, and I know probably some people here, some listeners are kind of just like, why would we even be talking about the Democrats? They're so useless. Other people would be like, no, you know, it's all about the Democrats. Leaving those arguments aside, just kind of neutrally trying to think about what this party's about, whether you like it or don't like it. Two states that the Democrats really overperformed in 2016. This is a way of encapsulating the kind of fork in the road, I think, for the party, were Virginia and Nevada, right? Very different. Both states, you know, Hillary Clinton held, consolidated, did better than expected. She won, you know, around 3 to 5 points in each state. Both states, in some ways, very superficially, from the perspective of the media, in some ways have some similarities there, have very large, you know, non-white populations. You know, it's about, Nevada's about 62% white, Virginia's about 67% white, so they're diverse. But the coalition that supported Clinton is incredibly different. In Virginia, her, you know, obviously we know, people who aren't white didn't vote for Trump, like, at all. So we know that. That's the commonality. But in Virginia, voters who made over 100,000 went for Hillary by something like 11 points, like a really huge surge. She won, you know, Fairfax. She won Falls Church. I guess I wrote about this.
I was actually going to say.
Okay.
Can you? No. But it's good. You did it. It was seamless.
Okay.
I was going to say.
Oh, now the seams are out.
Yeah, I know. I just exposed it. I turned it inside out. No, but I was going to say that what's interesting is and you're going there already, but how this kind of, what we're seeing now with the special election in Kansas, also with the DNC race, right, is I think a really interesting lens to measure how much the Democrats actually have taken away any of the lessons of the election.
Well, I mean, they have. They've taken. I mean, well, okay. Well, let me just finish that little Virginia Nevada thing. Just try to.
And
I'll
he
try
wrote.
To wrap
and
it
he
up.
Wrote a. No. I'm not pushing you. Stay there. Don't go anywhere.
Oh, okay.
Don't go anywhere.
I'm
just
not
making.
Going anywhere.
I'm just wrapping.
It's just
us
you
up.
And me. It's just
yeah,
us.
I know. Don't.
We're here.
I'll wait for you, Jack, or whatever. What is she saying?
Okay.
Titanic. It's not very auspicious because she bounced. Okay.
Rose.
Fair. So you wrote a great piece. This is one of the best things I read during the entire election season. And that includes stuff that that I wrote myself. So that's really, that's a big, big, just kidding. I'm not. Okay, so Fairfax County was a piece that you wrote for Jacobin. Fairfax County, USA. And the subhead is Hillary Clinton won suburbs in record numbers, but her campaign failed to mobilize workers of all races. So you look at you kind of go beyond the just racial, ethnic, education, economic analysis that people did in these like discrete spheres, right?
Actually, the whole article is basically one sentence: class is greater than race. Repeated.
No, right, but you don't actually say
that. For
about
2,000 words. Over and over again.
You do say though that.
No. It's, you don't separate those two things.
Right. Exactly. So you say that you look at the kind of the difference between how Hillary did and Obama did, and you note that Clinton ran 9 points ahead of Obama's 2012 tally among voters earning more than $100,000. This is in.
I mean, this is everywhere. I mean, like, Virginia's was a symptom of something much larger. That this was a conscious decision on the part of the Clinton campaign facing Donald Trump to say, okay, we're going to double down. We're going to win the Republican moderates in the rich suburbs who have the nice lawns, who read David Brooks, and they're appalled by Trump. And let's like appeal to the Trump's disgusting temperament and my sort of many years of experience in government, in sort of and relatively moderate sort of profile to some extent, you know, and it really didn't work enough because they didn't get nearly enough of the voters they were hoping to get to actually win the election.
Right, the firewall.
Because Republicans hate Hillary Clinton, so it was kind of a dumb strategy. But they did
not
get a lot. They did get a lot of. They did a lot better in the Atlanta suburbs, in the Nashville suburbs, and even in the Milwaukee suburbs, right, where they lost Wisconsin horribly. But they still did better in the rich Milwaukee suburbs because this was. I mean, it's not just the Clinton campaign. It's also like what the Democratic kind of party has become and sort of the way it has started to communicate itself to voters over the course of the past 20 years. But it's become much more legible for richer people and much less appealing for lower
who
income people. And yeah, and that means working class people of all sorts of races. I mean, the argument of that piece was not just that like the white working class didn't vote for Clinton. It was also about how black working class turnout was really low in places like Milwaukee, and there was some really good reporting on this actually even in the Times about people saying like
crazy.
Why what's in it for me in this election, like what does Hillary Clinton have for me, you know,
the
temperament appeal knock against Trump isn't going to do it for somebody in Milwaukee.
Or there was that guy who had been in jail, I don't know if you remember from the New York Times piece, and he basically blamed the Clintons for like the carceral state in that same piece. I thought
right,
was interesting.
Right. Yeah, there's all sorts of history with Clinton. But I mean, I think it was, I mean, I read it as about a strategic decision. They were like, we can afford to lose some of these voters because
right,
we're going to run up the score in the suburbs. And okay, so
Ed Rendell, I just quote Ed Rendell?
Okay. This is like the quote. Yeah.
Ed Rendell, by the way, is like the guy who says everything that the Democrats think but don't say out loud.
Yeah.
What he said,
I love
about,
guys like that.
Me too.
Yeah,
he's
yeah,
like the worst. And he covered up for judges who sent kids to jail for money. Anyway, he's a prince. So he said for every
like a slave. I mean, Ed Rendell's not a slaveholder. He does not own slaves. Ed Rendell is like a slaveholder in that when I'm studying the slaveholders, one of the things that is very satisfying is that whenever you want them to say something really ghoulish to establish your point, they'll say something even more ghoulish than that.
Right.
So they don't hide anything. They don't hide their vision of slavery in a world riven by, you know, racial hierarchy and bound labor to infinity. They never hide it. Neither does Ed Rendell hide his prejudices,
right,
which are not in favor of slavery, so far as we know.
Right, right. Unclear. For every one of these blue... So this is what he said. For every one of these blue-collar Democrats Trump picks up... this guy's a former Pennsylvania governor, by the way. So for every one of these blue-collar Democrats Trump picks up, he will lose to Hillary two socially moderate Republicans and independents in suburban Cleveland, suburban Columbus, suburban Cincinnati, suburban Philadelphia, suburban Pittsburgh, places like that. So that kind of lays out where he thought the Clinton campaign would be going.
And that worked. Okay, let's look at a place where that worked. That worked in Virginia. Like, they won. They ran up the score in Fairfax. They crushed in Falls Church. They did well in Loudoun County. If you know, these are all the sort of, like, very wealthy, ring counties in Northern Virginia. Lots of postgraduate degrees, lots of six-figure incomes. They did really, really well in those places. And so that's the Virginia model. Just because I want to go back. I feel like we left this hanging Chad out there. Virginia, Nevada. Like, people are like, what's he going to say about Nevada, though? What's happening in Nevada?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
So there's the Virginia model. That's the Fairfax County USA model. Actually, did you have one more thing?
Just that the summary from that, the takeaway, right, is that the places that Hillary surpassed Obama were the wealthiest places.
Were the wealthy, like, overwhelmingly white, wealthy places.
Okay.
That's where she did well.
Okay.
And there's a faction in the Democratic Party that just genuinely wants that voting coalition because they want the politics of those people. I mean, there was a D.C. reporter who was like, you know, this Kansas race right afterwards, he was like very plugged in to the DCC strategy, and he's like, this Kansas race was, what did he say? It was like, this is batting practice, it's meaningless. The backbone of the Democrats, you know, the structural bedrock of the Democratic Party is the suburbs. I mean,
right.
So I'm not making this up. Like,
the
numbers show it, but Rendell will say it.
Right.
Reporters, there's reporting on it. It's a real thing. They want there's a faction of the party that really wants the Virginia strategy because the Virginia coalition will support the kind of the sort of economic policy that they really want.
Did you coin that term, the Virginia strategy?
No.
Oh.
Yeah, I just just now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
3 seconds ago.
Yeah, okay, you're witnessing history.
But Nevada is very different. And Nevada is like this weird exception in the sort of morass. I mean, Jay McAlevey was on the show, so she's great. And she was talking about that, and nobody's really talking about this. Or if they, maybe, okay, whenever, I can't believe I just said that. Nobody's talking, why isn't anybody talking about
this? Except the Katie Helper
Whenever
show.
Somebody's saying that, people are definitely talking about it. So somebody's talking
not
about
enough.
It, but we're also going to talk about
right.
it.
And Jay McAlevey's an organizer.
So. Jay McAlevey's a labor organizer who spent, you know, several years out in Nevada organizing hotel workers. Hospital workers. Anyway, and she was talking about how Nevada flipped blue at every level this year in terms of not just went decisively for Clinton in a huge Trump wave year, but also at the local level, at the state level, Nevada was very strong blue. And what was the coalition in Nevada? It points to a very different path of politics than the Virginia coalition. In Nevada, Clinton lost overwhelmingly people making over $100,000 a year. And I think that's good. I think that's good, and to some extent. I think that's good because those people are the people that if they're in the coalition, they can't. They will deny the things that we need right. in our coalition. If you want things like Medicare for All, if you want things like a job guarantee, they're the haters.
Right.
So, and I mean, okay, look, you want to build a majority, you have to have some woke rich people. That's good.
Right.
I mean, yeah, I ride the Northeast Corridor. I always stay in the quiet car. So, look, I know what I'm talking about. I know these yuppie people. Yeah. I'm one. But look, if you want to build the majority coalition that can give you the Bernie Sanders style policy, if that's something that you're interested in, if that's a project that you believe in, then you need a Nevada-like coalition, which is overwhelmingly working class. I think Hillary won in Nevada. The Democrats won something like people making under 30 grand by like 40 points. It was overwhelmingly, this is multiracial. This is a multiracial working class. You know, heavily Latino, heavily Asian, Filipino, Black in Las Vegas. Heavily union, even though it's a right-to-work state, there have been remarkable unionizing victories there among casino workers and McAlevey now organizing, helped organize hospital workers. It's a coalition that points in a very different direction, policy-wise, but also kind of politics-wise. Like, who do you try to organize? What messages do you convey to your worker, to your voters? Who do you want on your team? And there's a fundamental tension between the Nevada strategy, such as it might exist, or such as it might look like on a national scale, and the Virginia strategy, which is just wait for demographics, like kind of impersonally, and, you know, kind of moderate Republicans to sort of eventually just get sick of Trump and put the Democrats back into power without doing anything at all of substance.
Right. And so we have the Virginia model and the Nevada model, but we have to also account for the possible McAlevey effect.
Yeah,
she's
that's true.
She's a really good organizer.
She's really good.
She's really
Although
good.
She's really good. That's true.
What were we going to say?
Send McAlevey to Wisconsin.
Yeah, Wisconsin.
I wasn't McAlevey in Wisconsin. I heard McAlevey didn't visit a union hall in Wisconsin the entire campaign.
She probably, the same people who were blocking the landing strip for Hillary were probably camped out for McAlevey,
right.
So neither one could access it. I'm glad
got that. I'm going to pump McAlevey's book. If you haven't read both of her books.
Oh, yeah, No Shortcuts.
No Shortcuts, great book, but her account of union organizing, detailed account. Not that I actually know anything about this, so I've read one of these kinds of books, but it was a good book.
Top five, the ones you have read.
Raising Expectations.
Yeah.
About her days in the mid-2000s organizing hospital workers in not just nurses but all levels of hospital workers in Nevada and winning in a right-to-work state, which is more relevant than ever because we're looking at down the pipe at a right-to-work country, and if we accept that now it's right-to-work unions are completely dead, we give into that kind of paralysis and pessimism back to Frederick Douglass, then. Game over, because then it really is Virginia coalition or nothing.
Right.
If you completely give up on labor, if you give up on the possibility of an organized, working class that's fighting for something that it can actually win and believe in. So anyway, that's another pet peeve: people throwing up their hands about the state of labor and be serious, be honest, understand the obstacles. But I don't get the doom and gloom.
Yeah,
catastrophizing. Good verb. Yeah.
You can use it with your students.
Yeah.
Right after you don't ask them if they all know something.
Yeah, it's always good when you take an adjective and you put an ing on it.
Right, exactly.
That's good writing.
You know what I hate though? Impactful.
Yeah.
Or impact.
Or a noun.
Impact
even.
Is not supposed to be a verb.
Yeah.
Yeah, we let that happen.
It's an adjective, right? Impact.
No, it's not. It's having an impact,
it's a conjunction.
It's been bastardized into a verb.
Okay.
And I don't like that.
Okay.
You also write something. This I think we really have to talk about. So you're talking about the whole class. You have a really good response to Nate Silver's analysis, which you think is too kind of segmented. And friend of the show, friend of the show, friend of the show. Okay, FOS, FOTS. So you write...
Donald Trump has a 2.36 chance percent.
He was better. He was writer. He was writer. He was closer than anyone else, though, right? Besides,
On election day, yeah.
But he was.
I mean, those guys were so far out in front on how Trump had no chance to win the primary, which I don't know. Anyway.
So you write that people talked about education, not income, that guided the electorate somewhat overstates the case, even according to his own data. And you write a look at affluent suburban. Returns on a district and town level suggest that some combination of income, education, culture, and geography, in a word, say it with me now, class, drove Clinton's most dramatic gains. So what is the significance of discussing class beyond our kind of, political...
Well, look, I mean, I'm doing, kind of loose and crude thing there, too, because I'm mostly doing it based on income. But a little bit of geography.
Yeah.
But...
That's all
we
you need,
have,
a little bit,
I mean,
and then it becomes more than income.
I mean, I don't know. If you want to be academic about it, I mean, class is really a relationship. It's not a structure. That's sort of where I'm with E.P. Thompson on that to some extent. And I think what's important and relevant about class in the context of this politics is, do you believe, I mean, this is where the Virginia and the Nevada coalitions diverge. Do you believe in a politics that musters a class resentment against the haves, to some extent, or the oligarchs, or the 1%, or however you want to call them.
Oligarchs.
What's that accent?
Oh,
you're doing
Vernon,
great.
Yeah,
okay,
sorry.
Got it. Yeah, the oligarchs. Yeah, I love when they talk about oligarchs. The Republican Party in the 1850, anti-slavery movement, never shut up about oligarchs. We should use that word more.
Yeah. Own oligarch.
Yeah, monarchs, aristocrats, do it all. Americans hate that stuff.
We
really do. We love the royals, but we really hate aristocrats. So, in politics.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway...
and our personal
do you
life,
believe
too.
In a class politics that can, in a crude, rough, populistic sense, at minimum, mobilize to a certain degree resentment, but also a kind of just more than resentment, because that's just then you're giving into a right wing frame. Mobilize like a justified anger at an outrage at the concentration of wealth and power and the sort of, in effect, the kind of upward redistribution of wealth in this country over the past 30, 40 years. Do you actually believe in a politics that takes aim at that, or do you believe in a politics that like neutralizes that and tries to keep it off the screen? And that's what the professional Democratic Party believes that it can't. It's torn between a bunch of different people. Some people who just like genuinely don't want that ideologically.
Right.
Some people
who think that can't win. Right.
Some people who are trying to hold everyone together, and so they're just really soft and weak about it. It's really complicated, but. But I think if you take that element out, then you surrender hope for any like serious redistribution, any serious program for universal goods that can be demanded, any hope for rising expectations on the part of people who aren't born into a six-figure income.
Right. So we have to, guys. Unfortunately, the people who are just listening. Oh no, you're not. Remember Jack and Rose.
Oh,
Titanic.
Yeah.
We're staying on this ship together. Probably not the best
analogy. I
think
I'm an ice cube by now.
I know, yeah. Our radio listeners are going to have to go, sadly, because it's the end of our radio hour. But go on to the Katie Halper Show Facebook page, and we'll tell you how you can listen to the whole thing. And we're not going anywhere. And guys, if you're listening at home and you want to come by, we're still going to be talking, and then we're doing karaoke afterwards. So that is going to be very, very fun.
Long-time listener.
Yeah, long-time listener, yeah. So now...
First time guest. Wait, so we just go... Now it's just this.
Now it's just this, and you can curse. Yeah, you can curse. Wait
a
couple minutes. No, you didn't, but wait
oh,
a couple
didn't.
Minutes.
Okay,
I know.
Right.
So, okay, hopefully the people have transitioned away. But yeah, give us a couple... I know you've been holding back.
Really?
You curse I know you have been, because you curse a lot in your lectures. Okay, so...
What we've gotten so far is Ed Rendell... is a slaveholder. That's
yeah.
what we've learned.
If there's one takeaway.
That's what the radio audience has learned.
I know.
Oh my God, I'm screwed.
No, he may throw you into jail through one of his corrupt judges. Okay. So you talk about, what you just said, by the way, I think is so important. And it's kind of a mystery to me. And it also makes me feel like I'm in the Twilight Zone. Because I always thought that like people saw the difference between appealing to anger in a way that directs it towards the oligarchy and inequality and the powers that be in the corporations versus telling people to blame immigrants or Muslims, right? Or the disenfranchised people, right?
Yeah.
People, I don't know if they really believe this or if it's a mistake. There really is a sense that because Trump and Bernie Sanders both appealed to, first of all, Bernie Sanders appealed to various populations, and among young people, the majority of every demographic. And also, he also appealed to the majority of all ages to Arab Americans, which nobody talks about.
True. Native Americans, too.
There you go. You see? So every time, by the way, people say that Bernie didn't get any support from people of color, you should just tell them, that's yes, I agree, if you don't count Native Americans or Arab Americans as people. And then you know what you say. That makes you worse than Robert E. Lee.
Ed Rendell? Okay, yeah.
Same thing, okay. Exactly. I can't keep track of them. Yeah. There's
wine?
No, it's not. Oh, actually, we're on the. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
F, yeah. Okay, don't curse for a couple more seconds, though. A couple more minutes. Okay, in case we're still on the radio. But yeah, I don't get this. Like, I know I was raised by, like, super lefty reds and everything, and, like, my uncle was a big class warrior, labor organizer, but I always thought that, like, that we just knew that. Like, you take angry. This is what the labor movement kind of did when they weren't being really racist. Okay, but at its best, at its least racist, like, they're like, okay, you angry people are angry and you feel like you're not getting paid enough, right? And so here's the deal, guys. Don't blame your, like, the people who you see as competition, right?
Yeah.
The black workers, because they're actually your brothers and sisters. I mean, let's be real, brothers. Because they weren't that woke on gender that. Your brothers in struggle, right?
Yeah.
They are your comrades. They are your...
Right, right. I mean, sorry, keep going.
No. Can you give me... Can I just do the rest of the show as a monologue about class? And I'm just kidding. No, but, like... Yeah, go.
I was just gonna say we don't have to romanticize whatever racial.
I'm not,
and you would never do this. Nor would you make jokes about the Holocaust.
Well,
nor
that
about,
I would. Let's be
or
honest.
About interracial dating or
oh,
any
you
of your
that
great,
one?
Any
that
your greatest
good,
hits.
Right?
Yeah,
that was good, right?
Greatest hits.
I said that every.
Halper's greatest hits. Look, we don't have to romanticize like the mid-century labor movement, whatever. To say
we don't have to, but
no,
fun.
Yeah, okay. But you know, I'm a big fan of romance. You know, that's why I like Titanic so much. Yeah, exactly.
Matt's wife is in the audience. I just want to say, don't worry. I am very, as for how woke and kind of critical and radical as I am, I do respect the institution.
But look, the idea,
I'm
moving on. I'm moving on. Look, you don't have to romanticize like labor struggles past to say a couple things about, again, going back to my little Nevada coalition, Virginia coalition idea. The politics of the Virginia coalition, when it comes to something like race, when it comes to something like when it comes to redistribution generally, because I mean, like, look, let's give the devil the due. Tim Kaine, Senator of Virginia, who I think is kind of in some ways a really good poster boy, maybe more fair than Ed Rendell, who's out of politics and is kind of, you know, quotable everywhere. Tim Kaine supports, you know, a $12 minimum wage. Like,
right.
Tim Kaine is like economically progressive on a few things, and like, but what undergirds the politics of somebody like Tim Kaine, in my view, is philanthropy. It's based on a model of philanthropy. It's based on the model of, look, who are the most vulnerable members in society? Who are the people who are most most at risk? Who are the weakest? You know, usually don't put it that way because you're trying to be sensitive.
Right.
But who are the weakest? And who are the people who are most in need of my help as somebody who can sort of bestow it upon them in a kind of philanthropic or in a sort of charitable sense? Exactly. And
Catherine, don't worry.
And
don't worry.
That's not, I mean, what the labor movement can do, didn't always do, but is certainly has done at times and is certainly capable of doing, i.e. Jay McAlevey in Nevada, is building on a much different form of politics, which is not a politics of philanthropy, but a politics of solidarity.
And justice.
Where it's like, yeah,
justice.
You don't approach, a healthcare worker,
yes.
You know, like a sort of entry-level healthcare worker at a hospital in Nevada and say, oh, you're so vulnerable. Like, can we negotiate something that will, like, you know, give you a little bit more, save you money on your taxes, or sort of somehow, like, give you a few more bucks to help you get through the day, or even protect you from, like, the absolute worst of right-wing racism and reaction.
Right.
That, I mean, that's important. That's good. We should have the minimum of that. And, you know, sometimes we go too far, I think, in ripping on the Dems for being woke. It's like, it's better that they're woke now than, like, the Clinton Dems, you know,
Who
are, like, bad on economics.
We just don't want wokeness
and not
to
woke.
Cover up. We just don't want the
yes,
wokeness to
absolutely.
Distract
so
from their bad
I like
policies,
that they're woke.
But I agree
I welcome
with you. I agree
the
with you.
Woke.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's like Tim Kaine will offer a politics of, like, kind of woke rhetoric and philanthropy.
And death penalty and hide him.
Yeah, not to mention
not
he's got a bad record on some other things. But and he's not going to regulate the banks. He's not going to do any of that stuff. But he fundamentally, in terms of, I'm not even talking about policy. I'm talking about, like, his, like, style.
Right.
Of the style of the kind of Clinton-ish style of the Virginia coalition is – is about approaching people as, okay, there are people in Washington who are legislators who are primarily drawn from the other half of the coalition, which are the Fairfax County, Loudoun County, you know, lawyers and attorney, you know, lawyers and attorneys and also lawyers and people who have law degrees and no, and
esquires and counsel,
yeah,
counselors.
Professionals who are, they're the people who like have the skills, they have the human capital, they have the Ivy League degrees or equivalents. They're the ones who can get things done on behalf of the people who are basically kind of like just struggling to get by. And
right.
So therefore, we need to sort of do something for them. And say we whatever kind of policy disagreements are, that's a fundamental difference from a politics of labor and of solidarity, which says, look, we're in this together. We actually have common interests.
Right.
We have a mutual desire to line up against oligarchs. Even, you know, you make $78,000 a year, I make $20,000 a year. That's not, we don't need to like eviscerate those differences and pretend they don't exist. But fundamentally in this struggle, we can unite against somebody who's actually picking both of our pockets, who's preventing both of us from, you know, we're both living in a precarious situation where we could be bankrupt tomorrow if one of us gets sick. We both have, you know, kind of economic insecurity when it comes to jobs. And we can fight together for these like basic material things that will build then solidarity and a sense of like, and fundamentally it's about equality, really. I mean, I would go even beyond solidarity. It's about equality. The Virginia Coalition foresees is a coalition, but it's not a coalition of equals. It doesn't foresee equality existing in any kind of material way, in any kind of philosophical, substantive way. The idea of a Nevada coalition a la Bernie would be, which isn't, you know, taking the Bernie campaign and its strengths and weaknesses out of the equation.
Never.
The idea of a Nevada coalition would build on put equality front and center, like in the deepest sense that we are all in this together as, you know, as humans and as citizens or you know, or as you know, people who should be on a path to citizenship, whatever. Like it's, you know, that's the kind of politics that actually are going to be necessary and that can actually challenge power. Because you can't, if you have a coalition that's based on philanthropy and then you come up against power, there's no sort of organized basis to actually challenge right-wing power when push comes to shove.
Right.
And in a sense, we saw that with the compromise solution of Obamacare. You know, if there was, you know, which is the kind of the fruit of that kind of coalition, you're always going to get Obamacare's on Obamacare's on Obamacare's. And that's like the best. That's the best that coalition can produce. If you have a politics of solidarity, that's the only thing that can actually get you over the hump.
Right, because there, if you have charity, no, it's good, I like it.
Okay.
If you have charity, right, there's charity and philanthropy, and then there's rights and justice. And if something's not a right, they're alienable, right?
Nice.
I like that. Constitution throwback.
Yeah, no, I like the Constitution. I like the Declaration. That's one thing that Thompson actually did in Kansas. I'm like an expert on his campaign in the sense that I Googled it at 10:30 last night. Yeah. But I watched a bunch of his ads and I read his website a little bit. I think it's kind of, this is an unpopular take. I tweeted this too, but like a lot of people on the left are like, you know, since William Lloyd Garrison, since the abolitionists, they were like, let's burn the Constitution. It's a slaveholder's document.
Right.
It's bad news. Why should we be governed by this 18th century slaveholder's document? Okay. Historically, that's true.
Yeah. We don't like the three-fifths clause.
As a historian, that's completely true. But we should remember somebody like Frederick Douglass by the 1850s said, you know, look, we can actually use the Constitution. We can claim the Constitution. We can create, we can have an idea of an anti-slavery Constitution. And in fact, the Constitution has a lot of power for most Americans who like don't do things like come to the Brooklyn Commons and like hear like left wing talk radio, like all the listeners of the show. But for a lot of people in the world, in this country, the Constitution is something that they like or they want to like, and they don't know what's in it.
Right.
So
the communists did that, right? Like the Communist Party.
I mean,
And by the way, I wasn't romanticizing. Labor movement. I'm saying when it worked, it did that stuff. But the Communist Party knew.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's very annoying. You'll get people who are like, you know, F the Constitution, slaveholder's document, and they're right, as you said, historically. But the question is, and this is so much of politics has become this. It's like, it's take hot takery versus strategy. Like it's morality versus effectiveness. So I don't particularly care. The question is whether it can be subverted and framed in an effective way, right? And so,
I mean, James Thompson was talking about the Constitution because he was a civil rights lawyer who had basically made his name in the local community for standing up for victims of police violence, you know, including a lot of people of color in Wichita. And so he was claiming the Constitution not as like, oh, I'm in favor of the Constitution, like the way that like Bob Barr, call back to Bob Barr, there's a Constitution Party in America.
Right.
The right owns the Constitution, but you know, you stand up for the 14th Amendment as the sort of Reconstruction era amendment that's an anti-slavery document that grounds at least I think can be read to ground fundamental human equality at the center of the American experiment, that goes back to the Declaration of Independence. You use that, a la Frederick Douglass,
right.
and it's a civil rights constitution.
Right.
It's a constitution that's a bedrock against class power, against concentrations of power that undermine our equal unalienable rights. And that's an argument that I think, I don't know, that's interesting. So anyway.
I was going to say that the communist CPUSA did that, right? When they fought in the Spanish Civil War, their brigade was called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, right? There is Paul Robeson saying battle for the Americas, right? The Americans.
I mean, whatever. We can disagree on the tactics. Some people hate it. I think it's good.
I think Bruce Springsteen is another example, right? Although, don't throw that one out. That doesn't work.
Because he's being sarcastic.
I was going to say he kind of uses the American flag, but it's not really because it's subversive and
that's
sarcastic.
That's like Fight Club irony. That's just like, no, you really like to fight. Come on, Bruce loves America. He really does.
Yeah, he's
critical of it, and yeah, if you read the lyrics.
The whole thing is indicting the American government. But that's the thing. You can be a great patriot. Anyway,
he's indicting the government, but he loves the American idea.
Yeah. New Jersey is America somewhat in a nutshell. But deep cut. Okay. I do think that I keep thinking that this also applies to the Bible, right, into religion. And, like, I'm agnostic, technically, because I have, like, 1%.
I'm better on the Constitution than on religion.
I'm going to set you up so great. You're going to be an expert in a second. Like, it's the same principle, though, where people are like, oh, F religion, who cares, blah, blah, blah. It's a patriarchal thing. Martin Luther King used it pretty effectively to organize against all that stuff, right?
I like that we're now being like the new basis of left-wing politics in the United States is going to be centered on the Constitution and Christianity.
And the Bible, yeah. That was your assumption because what comes before Christianity? You're welcome, Christians.
Is it the religion that had the holiday that I forgot about the other day?
Pesach?
Yeah.
That's the best holiday because it's like about liberation.
Did you Seder?
This is how good Jews we are. Like, I think we're Sedering after it even stops.
Oh, is it tonight? I thought it was...
How many days is it, though?
Yeah.
Wait, it's over already?
Thank you.
I thought Passover... My family has, like, shrimp at Passover dinner.
My shiksa wife is trying to correct me on Passover.
I got so distracted by the talk of religion.
I know the days that I know.
David Walker, is that his name?
The holidays I miss.
Is that his name, David Walker?
David Walker, the appeal to the...
the guy who used religion.
The black abolitionist?
Based it all, a lot of it on the Bible, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. Oh, we want to talk about...
That,
oh,
no, no, no. I mean...
1820s
yeah,
deep
I
cut.
I wanted
me.
To...
Okay,
yeah, that was my goal this whole
David
time.
David Walker's great. I mean, David Walker...
He's doing great stuff.
David
amazing,
Walker...
Amazing, amazing.
David Walker is... You know, I'm hearing more and more things...
I know, it's so great.
...about David Walker. David Walker's appeal to the colored race of the world.
His words,
black
not abo-
yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah. That's in quotes. It's in italics. He was a black abolitionist in Boston in the 1820s, and this pamphlet was like sort of smuggled into the South. He was trying to get it in the hands of slaves and free blacks in the South. Kind of precipitated the Southern slaveholding effort to like censor the males. This fear that these words will get into the hands of slaveholders. Yeah, I mean, Walker's interesting because he says a lot of interesting things, but he definitely grounds it in Christianity.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he points out the hypocrisy of kind... I mean, that's the thing. He points out the failure of sort of slaveholding Christianity to sort of in any way approach its stated intentions.
Right. Yeah. I'm fine. I'll make a liberation theology argument. Christians may not like it if they know that I'm a secular Jew, but anyway, I'm flexible. Okay, so... you talk about something really important that I think we have to talk about, which because nobody's talking about it. You write that you talk about this bifurcated coalition.
I like that you printed out my article from like November.
Yeah, well, it's really, really good. You talk about, on the one hand, there's a growing contempt for the white workers who have slowly drifted away from the Democratic Party. On the other, an essentially philanthropic, if not paternalistic, concern for the most vulnerable non-white workers who ostensibly remain within the Democratic camp. This has given us an elite liberal discourse that grows eloquent about questions of privilege and empathy, but cannot seem to imagine a politics of power and solidarity. It has given us a liberalism that adores means testing and looks askance at universal goods, not because universal goods are too expensive, but because they might benefit someone who isn't deservingly deprived. Okay, this is something I've seen a lot of, right? This idea that... you can't have universal programs because if a rich person gets something for free, that's not fair. And low-income people, the theory goes, are going to be really upset about it. So, sorry for repeating myself, people who listen to my radio show, but again, Newt Gingrich didn't have the term, like, Social Security queens for a reason, because right. everyone gets Social Security, right?
Right?
So I think it's pretty clear to anyone who looks at policy that when you have universal programs, they're much less vulnerable to getting cut, right? No one's going to cut something that everyone gets because the wealthy people aren't going to want to get rid of that either, right? So do you really think that, like, people think that it's unfair? All of a sudden these people have a sense of, like, justice that they don't usually have? This is a bit of a leading question. Or do you think they're really against universal programs and try to wokeify their argument?
Well, yeah.
Like the one time they care about economics.
I think there are, like, different strands. I mean, if you actually want to get beyond the polemic on how
I don't
the
really.
Democrat,
so
no, yeah,
let's
you don't.
Stay in
That's
the
not what your business is. But whatever, I'm going to do it.
No, do
like,
it.
I think there are different, like, strata within the Democratic Party that have different attitudes. I think there are some people that are ideologically hostile and materially hostile based on their interests and based on their beliefs to anything that is going to raise their taxes. And that's a big chunk. Right. That's a really powerful chunk. And they're going to find any way to sort of talk about it by if they're Democrats, they'll either mention, oh, we can't raise taxes on the middle class like Hillary did, or they're going to, like, try to avoid even thinking about it in those terms because they don't want to have that conversation because they know they're going to be, like, a hit from the left on that. So there's some of those people. There's some people outright say it. Then there's some people who dodge it. If we sort of move progressively from right to center, they're the outright, like, never raise taxes. Like, they're the sort of hardcore neoliberal centrist, right?
Oh, I didn't even know
then there's, you know, we can never raise taxes on anybody, you know, except for maybe the ultra-rich,
right.
But not even, you know, some people don't even want to do that. But then moving to the middle, those people, forget them. But then there are the other people who I do think are in some ways more interesting who think that, who do sort of have this take that it's just, I mean, it is sort of mysterious. I'd actually like to have honest dialogue with somebody in this zone. I mean, I can think of some writers who kind of occupy this place who are like,
no, we'll have them here at debate.
Yeah, who are just like, no, it's actually like they, some of it is like an aesthetic preference for complexity. I think there is a little bit of that, like the Vox style of politics, like, oh, we want wonkery. But I think it's deeper than that. I think they think they want a politics that, because of the philanthropic orientation, which I think is kind of pretty significant, they want to help the people who need help. They really believe in
right.
this. These are the sons and daughters of privilege. These are the people who grew up. These are the people who I went to school with my whole life. And
yeah.
And like, I think, I mean, maybe I'm one of them. I don't know. And I just am trying to use, doing it in a different vocabulary. But like, there are people who think that their mission is to, like, uplift people who need help. And they don't want any kind of universal program because it, or they're, maybe even they don't hate it, but they just, like, don't know what to make of it. They think it's this instrument that's not about helping the people who need the help. And that's what I'm going to try to do. And
they're just,
I mean, and that explains, to be honest, that's the mentality, trying to be sympathetic. I do think we should try to be sympathetic just enough to understand, not to like weaken our opposition, but to understand so we can attack better.
Right, exactly.
But
know your
that
enemy.
Explains like the charter school impulse too. It's the same kind of thing. It's like, we want to help. We want to help these people who are vulnerable. It's like, they're not, these people aren't, I have these charter school
these
friends.
These people.
I just did that.
No,
I did it.
Hey,
I did the Robert E. Lee.
People, I'm fine.
These people.
No,
but they want, they're not
guys,
robots.
Guys, come in. Sorry, come in and move to, there's a center table.
They're not robots who just, like, get off on, like, you know, get high on, like,
taking
burning teachers, union cards or something.
Public education.
They think they're helping. And they think they're doing it because they want to make this immediate impact in the lives of the people who immediately need it.
Sure, like,
and
they'll wait
for
the
charity.
Revolution,
it's,
they don't want,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's philanthropy, and it's fundamentally reactionary because it's like presumes an unchangeable status quo of power and resources.
I think it's much easier to debate someone who's wealthy and privileged who makes that argument. I think what's interesting is when you have someone from an underserved community who's, like, been to the public schools, sees the failures of it, and then they come with that perspective, and they're like, well, I would love to live in a world where it's where we really work on public school, but I was in it, and it sucked, and so meantime, until this comes. Anyway.
Right.
But,
And that's, that is the, generalizing that out beyond the education example, that is something that is a tool of the sort of people who want to do the Virginia strategy is because that coalition is not just like a rich white coalition. Those are the people who are calling the shots, but it's important for them to kind of have a kind of some kind of an alliance. I mean, I think they really see it. I mean, this is where, you know, we can, again, debate terms. I really don't like this term ally because it presumes that it's like there are these two different groups that are unbridgeable and have no interest beyond like this like one moment where they're together.
But I like allyship. I don't ever want to give up that word. So sorry.
Do you? Okay, well, whatever.
I'm kidding.
I don't know.
I think it's no.
Oh, okay. 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 All right. Whatever. But I think it's like, I think I like solidarity over allies or whatever because it's like, no, we're so different. We can't be together. We can't, we have no commonality.
Right.
And they, so the, yeah, they
affinity group.
Yeah. Anyway, whatever. But I think that's the kind of that those are the kind of arguments that this kind of vision of politics will deploy aggressively because they know it's hard to fight back when people are saying, look, the current system is so messed, is so bad. The right is so dangerous. All we can do is this one tangible thing, and that would be better than not doing it.
Right.
Well,
and I think there's also a danger, right? Because we look at biography, kind of, and we look at identity as being these, like, it's pretty infantilizing, right? But it's like, oh, this person who is of a certain group has this idea, so therefore they are right, and they are righteous, and they are woke, and people who aren't from that group can't say anything about it. But that, of course, flattens these different groups into monoliths, right? Like, Black people have ranges of politics. Like, this is one of the things that drives me crazy. It's like, people present it as, like, white people, we have all these different politics, right?
Right.
But people of color, there's just one, there's like one position.
Yeah, when you say class, it's almost like assumed you're talking about just white people.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right, as if there's like no class politics in outside of white people in the United States.
And of course, the irony is that when like Bernie Sanders, not to bring it back to him, but when he talks about the working class and people are like, how dare you just talk about white working class? I'm like, do you realize the tell you just did? You showed your hand big time. He didn't say white working class.
Right. It's so complicated because, I mean, there is some truth to this idea that like working class gets like raced as white. Like there is some truth to, because when you read like the New York Times and like, you know, certain kind of like moderate commentator, you know, the David Brookses, when they talk about like we need like working class voters feel left behind, they're absolutely talking about white people. And so they do that. And then that kind of becomes embedded.
Sure,
and then
it
does. So there's like some legitimacy to that critique that when you say working class, you mean white people. But it's like, that's not actually true.
Right.
So we shouldn't like let David Brooks define our terms for us.
Right. And I don't think Sanders is like a Brooksian.
No.
But I think that people, I want to open up for questions, but maybe you could
You saw the Imolaki ad. I mean, that was like the most powerful presidential the tomato workers in Imolaki, Florida. Bernie did his campaign where he talks about the sort of exploitation, these like heavily like Latino workforce in South Florida that are, you know, that were, you know, making like starvation wages and were being brutalized by their employees. And, you know, there was like a little bit of a campaign. Sanders got involved. I don't know how important he really was, but the point is he was using this as a representative instance of how, you know, the working class, you know, it was fundamentally a working class. It was an ad about the exploitation of a working class, which was like not white at all. And he literally rises to this crescendo where he's like, who profits from this? I can't do a Bernie.
Who profits from this exploitation?
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. And that's the working class. That's the good Bernie.
Nevada.
That's the Nevada coalition that we need. And that's there. It's there. It's there for the taking, except the Virginians are in the way, like Robert E. Lee.
Get him out of here. Get him out. So now, Bernie would have won. True or false? Go.
True.
Why? What do you say to, how do you?
Oh, I thought this was like the end. Like, that's usually how we go out. Just Bernie would have won. Just like, we sort of repeat it at night.
Oh, it's kind
of
like, right. You know, it's like, Father, I my soul to whatever.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
If
the
I don't.
Kingdom come, thy will
thank
be
you.
Done. Bernie would have won.
Exactly.
Oh. That's pretty good. Pretty
don't
good.
Pretend. I
should have saved that for the radio.
I know. Yeah. Man, no, we'll get it up there, but that's great. You didn't even know. Was that fake or were you?
No, I just came up with it. I don't know why I even know that much of the Lord's Prayer. That is, that's.
Because you're a closet. You're a closet Christian.
Yeah.
So. What would you say? There are a couple different arguments, then we'll open up to questions. But there are a couple different arguments about the Bernie would have won thing, right? That
does
I've heard.
Think here's where I think it matters.
Yes.
Look,
it
look
does
we
matter.
Can relitigate the primary, blah, blah, blah. That's stupid. Why does it matter? Because it means, again, to go to what I've been saying this whole time, it goes back to this idea of a Nevada coalition.
Right.
It goes back to, like, if you say, saying Bernie won would have won points to the possibility of a political struggle that can defeat right-wing power on the basis of on the basis of some sort of common interest.
And is applicable to right now and moving forward, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's a rejection of a sort of a fatalism about A, the kind of implacable power of white supremacy. Look, you don't have to underestimate the power of white supremacy in the United States in order to believe that it can be beaten. Frederick Douglass never underestimated the power of white supremacy in the United States. It's extremely powerful. But it can be beaten. It can be beaten. It was beaten in the election of 1860. It was beaten in history.
No one talks about that anymore.
I was teaching the election.
1860, they were doing wonderful. Here's a fact
I taught my kids today. You know that word miscegenation? Yeah. It's a creepy word. I hate that word. Do you know where it came from? The campaign of intermarriage, whatever. It came from the campaign or sex, whatever. It came from the campaign in 1864 when the Northern Democrats were trying to make the most appalling, virulently racist, white supremacist arguments against Lincoln on behalf of McClellan, against Lincoln's war of emancipation. And they grounded everything. They threw everything into white supremacy. And they lost. They lost in a landslide. And, the point is not that white supremacy isn't powerful; it's super powerful. But it can be beaten. Sometimes it wins, sometimes it loses. And Bernie would have won it's a response to a lot of things. But one response, it's one insistence against the idea that there was a sort of the Trump wave was irresistible because it summoned some kind of demon of white supremacy that can never ever be beaten. Right. I mean, if you believe that, we really should move to Canada.
You might
we really
as well
should
become
get the
a
hell
yoga
out of
instructor.
Here.
That's what Becky Bond said. She said, if you think she was a Bernie organizer, she goes, if you think that Trump couldn't have been beaten, and here's the irony: people who make that argument, they're also the same people who constantly remind us that Hillary won the popular vote. So they're actually contradicting themselves, right? But I think that the Bernie would have won thing, the reason it's important, and I'll admit it's probably not the most useful thing if we want to have a dialogue. That doesn't stop me from wearing a pin that says Bernie would have won.
I really hate
or
to let
you
it go,
from having something on your wall at a party, for
probably,
instance,
probably,
where people pose in front of it and
probably
says,
we should start to let it go. I hate to admit that.
Well, yes and no. But I think the reason it's not relitigating the primary is because it is exactly determining a blueprint for moving forward. And again, if you think that Bernie's plan was not feasible or wouldn't have won, then clearly we can't do any of the things he did, right? And obviously Bernie's a proxy for things. But whether or not you respond to white supremacy by saying nothing, in which case guess where the angry white people go? To Trump? I mean, I don't understand this. Or do you say, hey, angry white people, don't go to Trump. Let me explain to you who you really should be angry at. By the way, I'll also offer you the same programs that I offer people of color, right? So there's this idea that making the case to white people, you're somehow then depriving people of color of their rights. But Sanders' programs go to everyone. I don't really understand.
So do you want a majority to topple right-wing power in the United States? Do you actually want it and that can deliver universal redistributive goods to all Americans?
That's what I think so many of them don't. So the major arguments I've heard about Bernie would not have won are that he's Jewish, which that's fine if you want to say that, except if you want to say that, then you can't call me sexist if I say that that's why Hillary wouldn't have won, which I don't say.
I'm in a swamp.
Sorry.
Here. Okay, anyway,
I'm just.
I get it.
Opportunity I have, I like to point out the hypocrisy of the Bernie wouldn't have won camp. But it's that he's Jewish and that there's this rape thing, and we can talk about this on another show. He wrote an essay that was critical of the fact that that there are rape fantasies in society. I don't know if you guys read this, and that he had a love child,
and then
he went to the Soviet Union.
Katie. I don't think anybody
I did.
Read that.
It's whatever. He went to the Soviet Union for his
honeymoon.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think
rules.
Of these. Yeah, it kind of does. Yeah. I don't really think that any of these things are insurmountable. I think that having written an essay critical of rape, not of rape fantasies, not shaming anyone, but critical of a society in which they they're common, I don't think that that would have disqualified someone running against a guy who then we found out said that he liked to, grab women by the pussy, right? So,
You really want to do this counterfactual history.
I do. Yeah.
You're
of
like
course.
My students who are like, "Oh, If Lee had held the high ground on the second day of Gettysburg, then this whole Civil War would have been different."
And Stephen Jay Gould, I saw him speak at Wesleyan, and he talked about contingency and unpredictable directionality. And I get it, it's a counterfactual, but don't you think sometimes that's such a cop-out? Of course it's a counterfactual.
No, you need to have
a historian, not a philosopher.
If you do causality, you have to have counterfactials. But
I do causality.
For the purpose of politics, I want to stick with the not counterfactual with the what is the political meaning of Bernie would have won now.
Yeah.
And I think the political meaning is forward, not backward. The political meaning is not about I mean, you could argue maybe we should just stop saying it altogether. But to the extent that there is this like hardcore faction of kind of corporate Democrats that like really that are coming up with both structural and, you know, Russia driven explanations for Clinton's defeat.
Which does not excite anyone, right?
Then, I think it's useful to bash them with that. I mean, fundamentally, though, it's about this is what the whole Bernie campaign was about to me, what the legacy is. It's about possibility. It's about the possibility of wanting more from our political system.
Frederick Douglass quote, cut to the Frederick Douglass quote, ooh. Power concedes nothing.
Power concedes nothing without a demand. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
If there is no struggle.
There is no... getting the things progress.
Yes, good.
Okay, so here I'm gonna read a quote and then I'm gonna open
we're
it.
We're dying
right?
on the raft and we're like trading Frederick Douglass quotes back to each other as we
the
slowly
Titanic?
Expire in the icy waters of the
I
North
survive.
Atlantic.
Sorry, yeah, I do. Women
yeah,
live
my
longer.
Last words are yeah, yeah.
Your last words are Bernie without, would have won, but maybe we shouldn't say that. Okay, so here's a quote. This is why I think that we do need to. Fine, we don't have to say Bernie would have won, but we can say if you say Bernie wouldn't have won, you're a terrible person. That's useful. I think we can both agree, right?
Just kidding. Yeah.
Okay. Here's why we have to, I think, talk about how electable Sanders was, and we can frame it in a way. We don't have to say Sanders. We can
you're
say
not done with this.
Any secular Jew from Brooklyn with a strong New York accent.
I love that
to
you
Vermont.
Are you are more hardcore in this than me. I love this.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. So here's why I think we need to talk about it. Ready? Jennifer Palmieri. Do you know her? She is. She's Clinton's. Comms director. She was Clinton's comms director. Not to be confused with Sally Albright, who worked for Clinton comms in 08, in case you wonder why Clinton lost. So she said she was on Meet the Press, Jennifer Palmieri, bless her heart, after Clinton lost. And Chuck Todd was like, I bet you're wondering where the excitement was before on November 8th, because he shows all these protests that are happening. And she's like, it's not a very helpful question. It was like, actually, my heart went out to her. She's still processing it. And she was talking about these, you know, all the protests, all the anti-Trump stuff. And she said to Chuck Todd, you are wrong to look at these crowds and think everyone wants $15 an hour. Don't assume the answer to big crowds is moving policy to the left. I think the answer to big crowds is engaging as much as you can and being as supportive as you can. What these people want, these
engaging
people.
Engaging
yeah.
as much as you can?
Yeah. What these people want, it's all about identity on our side now. They want
these
to.
These people. That's the theme
yeah.
of the night.
Yeah, I know. This episode will be called "These People" yeah. with Matt Carp and Katie Albert and Ben
people.
Norton and Ersten. They want to show he does not support me. I support refugees. I support immigrants in my neighborhood. I want to defend you. Women who are rejecting Nordstrom's and Neiman Marcus. This is power to them. I think it's our own version of identity politics on the left that's more empowering and that's a safer place to be. Safer for whom, first of all? But I love this idea that you have...
I love the Nordstrom's and Neiman Marcus. I mean, it's so funny about what the Democratic Party's become. I don't know how many times on Twitter...
Sorry, finish your thought. This is like an Ed Rendell, Robert E. Lee slaveholder moment. Jen Palmieri, also a slaveholder. Where they say the stuff that you think that they don't say out loud. She's literally saying she's... weaponizing identity politics, literally, to say don't do 15 an hour.
Yeah. No, it's ridiculous. And that's, I mean, that is the sort of hard, that is the hardcore of, I mean, she's the servant of the sort of the most reactionary instincts within the party. I mean, but I think what's so funny is like the way this sort of like the class presuppositions like slip out just like in this almost casual way. She's like, women are saying no to Neiman Marcus. Like most women like in America like have any... having
right.
clue what Neiman Marcus
right.
is or what
most
relationship
of them
they
say
have
no
to it.
To them anyway,
can you believe it? They said no to Nordstrom. Now things are getting serious. I mean, my favorite thing, my favorite tick of the press. People have talked about this. But I was noticing this for a long time. So I thought about it. Since somebody else tweeted it. Maybe I don't know. Is this comparison, this analogy that a lot of like pundits and like Democrat types have doing in regard to Medicare for All and Obamacare? It's like. We just renovated. You know, how can you renovate the? I mean, this has come up a bunch of times. How can you renovate the kitchen when you've somebody's trying to set your porch on fire?
Right.
That's like the idea. It's like, no, defend Obamacare. Don't renovate the kitchen. But 538 on their podcast before the election was like, we just redid the kitchen. You're telling me we need to do it again now? American voters are having none of that. And it's like this, just like this bedrock. This like Fairfax. That is so Fairfax County. Like. Redoing your kitchen is like the basic analogy which we're going to understand how politics happens. But that's like literally, this is unthinking. It's not, Nordstrom, Neiman Marcus. This is the suburbanization of everything. Yeah. This is the Montgomery Mallification. Sorry, shout out to Montgomery County, Maryland, of American politics. And this is supposedly the Progressive Party that's doing it. It's revolting. Sorry.
It is revolting. Yeah. There, I got you with me. Yeah. You're just as judgmental as I am. That's what I want to do. I was baiting you.
Medicare for all. Literally, there are 30 million. There are almost 30 million people who don't have insurance. They get sick. They go bankrupt or they die.
Yeah.
And that's redoing the kitchen.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's redoing the kitchen. No, it's like they want. They are like. I'm trying to think of what they're advocating for. It's like the house is crushing people. There are people under the house that are dying. Yeah. Right. The house is like it's sinking, and they're like, "Why do you want to fix the foundation?
Witch.
We just put
it's,
in
it's
these."
It's like the Wizard of Oz, right?
Yeah.
That's the uninsured. So we need. To, yeah, exactly.
You don't even
it's
know that
like
the episode
that.
I'm behind on posting. We talk about the Wizard of Oz. So weird. Ooh. But Adam Gaffney was on the show. He's a doctor and a single payer advocate,
is
and
he single?
Says, "I don't know, Adam." He said, people who tell you that you can't do something often are the people who don't want to do something. And that's what he was saying about single payer.
Yeah.
So
I listened to that episode, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You think? It should have stuck with you.
No.
You heard my
dad.
He
was in a bunch of interviews. No, but he was with you.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And then I played my dad, who's a doctor who looks like Einstein. I asked him if single payer would work. He said yes. And I said, how do you know? Because he's a psychiatrist. I want him to explain that. He didn't know I was filming him. And he was like, because I know. Bernie texted me. It was very funny. Okay. Well, thank you guys so much. Matt Karp, thank you so much. Matt Karp.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you.
We'll be done. Say it with me. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done.
Bernie would have won.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.